So we did Art of Savoring and Humility and Trust yesterday. If we could have the group that worked on royal personhood give us some response, and then we'll see what kind of discussion we can have. This is still in path one. This is theme 7, I recall. Who was in that group? Okay. So, will the three of you toss in a few ideas, or responses, questions?
Maybe we should just refresh everyone's memory.
Sure, why don't you?
He starts out by saying that for the Hebrew Bible, the idea of king was that God is king, and the earthly king was to do God's work on earth of keeping justice and keeping order and keeping out the chaos that threatened. And then we, as the heirs of that call, are entrusted with that work too, that we have a dignity as royal family, but we also have responsibility, as the royal family did, to see that justice is done. And I was thinking of this yesterday when you were talking about your freedom can't be taken away beyond what you allow it to be, on page 100, where he says, it's in the middle of the page, in the middle of the paragraph beginning, but with the dignity of all persons. On the part of the poor, the responsibility for justice making and preservation means being actively involved in asserting one's dignity, which means one's rights, and of letting go of oppressive self-images that others have handed on to one. You pointed out, Elmer, the quote on the middle of 101, mm-hmm. Stendhal saying that Jesus uses the word kingdom to mean creation. I don't understand that. If you try to substitute creation for all the other places where kingdom is used.
Mm-hmm. What do you think it does mean?
I can't think of how to do it in non-sexist terms.
You want advanced forgiveness and try it?
The reign or rule of God ultimately over all things, but that's the ongoing creation, not only the creation of the.
Well, then I suppose if that's what you think Christa Stendhal means by creation. It seems to me that what you said is what both of them may well mean. That my kidding about my past is that the big Missouri Synod congregation I grew up with, the kingdom of God was clearly identified, not with the church, but with that parish. And that was the kingdom of God. And the broader error, it seems to me, has been that the church has identified the kingdom with the church, whatever that may be. Whereas the rule of God, it seems to me, is all of whatever has been, it is, and whatever, God's activity in cosmos, the cosmic response. And so what I hear Stendhal saying, probably coming strongly out of the Pauline stuff and Colossians and the rest, that's an explanation of, in other words, of what Jesus was saying when he said, the kingdom of God, the rule of God is like this, that it was all encompassing, and that the church's task, as I think Fox tries to say, is to signal whose kingdom it is. It isn't ours, it isn't whoever, it's always God's.
Why was Jesus always saying the kingdom of God is coming? Why didn't he say it's here?
We did all three, didn't he? I think at different times he did really all three. There were times when he said, the awareness of whose kingdom it is, and that kingdom coming into a perfection, you know, into what it was designed to be. It allowed for
it to make it what it should be. You have to repent.
Correct. The kingdom is at hand. Repent. It's here. It all is, as you said. You didn't have to make a new one. God's intent and God's rule is always going on, even when we seek to thwart it, or when the world does. Or,
what about my kingdom is not of this world?
For me, that means what he is saying didn't come out of the systems of the, that had been set up around it, but it was beyond that whole thing. Maybe
then. If you go on with that verse, it says, my kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight. You know, meaning my kingdom is of another.
Temple.
Yeah.
Is another reality, not a violent, but a...
So world does not equal creation at this particular point. The word world is a difficult one.
Mm-hmm. It's one of the two Bible verses I know, so I like it.
Yeah, you did that good well.
After you read hundreds of Bibles.
Eleanor noticed particularly this quote on page, can you point it out, on page 94?
Let's see.
About the epistles. And
oh, yeah. I have looked in the same agenda as Elmer, mm-hmm. parochial school, and we were not made to feel like members of the kingdom. My mother was very open-minded, and she knew the neighborhood kids would go to the vacation Bible school that was off in the neighborhood if the Langberger girls didn't, so the Langberger girls went. It's by the pastor that said that's a no-no. So this will open the this little gospel light of mine and your child of the king is, is part of my childhood in spite of the school has brought it in. And this, and I'm interested in children, grandchildren, and young people. So this particularly spoke to me because I don't think this school is doing an excellent job right now, but I don't think that this bottom area especially, you have the capacity for anything. Yes, you are a marble. And when you grew up, can you harm another who is like you in marble? You know, I think we missed the boat I shouldn't say missed the boat, but I think there's an ad that you mentioned that we need to teach our children. Thank you.
94, the large
that Pablo Casuals put out. One particularly talked to me because my interest in young
there is still in this school too much of we're special because we're Missouri Synod Lutheran. And it's subtle things. My son's volunteer for basketball coaching, and they were playing groups around the neighborhood, around the community, but the young man that had charge of setting things up took a call to California. So this year the principal set it up, and what happened? We're going to Tacoma, and we're going across the bridge to somewhere else. We're playing all these Lutheran schools. And not only the time involved, the money involved, and we're doing this exclusive Lutheran thing again. And this particular son quit volunteering because of the time element, the cost, and it was against his basic principles of what he was trying to work out with these kids, so he just fell out. But that's what happens just as soon as somebody that's interested in this broader scope drops out, they're right back under the Concordia system they were raised. It's been programs whole highway during their high school and college education. Maybe I'm too critical, but these things have bothered me. And if I'm on left field with that, that's okay. Somebody's got to rattle the cage. Well, that's enough.
Anyone else? Carol, you have something to chime in with?
Thank you. dignity and then responsibility. How do you... You can't teach responsibility, but how do you get the reaction of responsibility?
Oh, yeah, that's on page 99. We have the line quite a bit on the page.
In the large paragraph, right?
No, we underlined quite a bit. We didn't argue. We all agreed, but we couldn't put it in two sentences. But we each had a different page. It spoke to us about a different area of the whole.
Sarah?
Well, let's see. Just to kind of preface it a little bit, what this is, you know, maybe to lift up our eyes and look at the forest again for a minute before we come back to the trees. This is the Via Positiva. And I think that one of the important messages that I have is that in the lives of Indian people, American Indian people, the indigenous native peoples of this land, is that there is indeed a Via Positiva that has survived the experience of being the indigenous people. And just to sort of look back a little bit on yesterday before we come to that, in the spirituality of the traditional people, there has been for generations some of these basic awarenesses, an awareness, for example, in Native American spirituality, that the energy, the creative energy of God exists in all creation. And I have seen some artwork by a Plains that shows, for example, the buffalo, and running beside the buffalo, with the buffalo, is the spirit image of the buffalo. And I think this connects with this concept of the creative energy of God, the indwelling spirit. There was a problem with translation, a tremendous problem with translation, in the early reportings of what Indian faith was. And so that when people began to realize that in sharing their life, Indian leaders and spiritual people would be talking about the sacredness of that tree or that stone or that animal, that the meaning of what they were trying to say, the more accurate translation, instead of spirit in the sense that has been attached to Native American spirituality. To me, the more complete translation would be to capture some of this concept of the indwelling spirit of God in the living things, so that for Native people, this house is a sacred place and a spirit place, an expression of the whole of creation. And when this house is supported by these trees, which we would in the Northwest have a tree as the roof support of the house. In our creation stories of the Northwest, the trees are the capture the essence of creation and the cornerstones of the house. So that when you stand in this place and touch that tree, you know, that tree right there spans generations and is an expression of life. And so that I would share with you that that is a sacred tree. I see the creative energy of God in that tree. I have a sense of seeing, and I think this is a little bit of the translation of that. So, just to kind of keep going on here, creation as blessing and recovering the art of savoring pleasure, to understand, again, the problems of translating when first people came in and experienced Indian people, and they, you know, they thought that they were immature because when they killed the buffalo, they ate and ate and ate and ate and ate and ate until, you know. Especially the early pioneers who maybe would, you know, begin to think about saving this kill, you know. And it would be hard for them to understand why that this would be totally consumed. And I think we're getting at the concept of creation as blessing, as blessing, as honoring the gift, savoring the moment, enjoying the feast. And that sort of touches back on theme 5 of trust, that the positive is that here amongst us has been a large kill, sufficient to all our needs and in abundance. And we celebrate the one that provides by participating in that abundance. And we express our faith in the continuation of that abundance. We express our trust when we consume and feast and savor this moment. Panentheism, that is another language that maybe you're understanding that can be translated into Native American experience. God is indwelling in me and you and in this moment and in everything, so that when I breathe the air, I am taking in creation. When I drink water, I am in communion or unity with God. When I wash myself, I am being touched by the hand of God. Every moment is sacred. Every step on the earth is sacred. If I move this book, I have affected the entire balance of the universe. And therefore, I think on what I do before I do it. Because we have a sense that everything is in balance. And we know that if I do something, I'm upsetting that balance or causing emotion in that balance. And so, that is another element that I think connects between Native American teaching, and a lot of Indian people teach those kinds of concepts. Those kinds of concepts are at the core and at the essence of their faith. The royal personhood, Indian people believe that this little child has come directly from the presence of God. Daniel is sacred because he is so close to having been with the complete presence of God. So that if you are with Indian people, you will see them keep their children right there. And you will see in a healthy Indian society the care of this sacred child is a sacred trust of every person, men, women, all ages. And inability to have children is considered to be, in many cultures, a tremendous sadness and difficulty. And in terms of understanding some of the customs of different groups, like the Eskimo people, have this gift of life is so incredibly special. And you might have a child, and in that society, there may be someone in need. A person in their middle age that doesn't really have a child of their own that is at that place where when they're old, they'll be taken care of. So that you might see one Indian family making this decision to take this newborn child and give it to someone who needs it. And that is an expression, I think, of giving, of saying that this, if there's a mother who has lost a child, then another person who maybe has an abundance of children, one of those children may be given to this woman who has lost her child, so that to replace, because they're very sensitive to that pain in that person's life and want to respond to that. And so in a lot of Indian cultures, you'll hear people use words like mother and father, and you won't understand. Like, there'll be a young person, 16 or 17, and he'll have a woman like yourself, and this is my mother, you know. And people say, what? And you know, because he that may be his grandmother, but he may have been given to you, so that in your next 20 years, you will have this young man in your life, and he will be providing for you and caring for you and there to be with you as you grow to the place where you need somebody with you. And that's a very common kind of thing, where this person who is young is a sacred gift from God. You can imagine the impact then on when federal policy was to take the children away to boarding school. And my mother was put in the mission school. You can imagine the meaning behind that, that they're taking away our God. They're taking away our blessings. They're taking away the incredible suffering that was brought on to Indian people in the early part of this century when the children were taken away. And this has not ended. I read the other day that 2/3 of all Indian children are taken away from their families and put into non-Indian foster homes to this day. And another thing that is happening is that 2/3 of all childbearing age women, Indian women in this country, are sterile, have been sterilized. This is the via negativa, and we will be getting into that. And we have to jump into that. But sure. The sense of a royal personhood and the assault on this royal self. The clash between the cultures has been very painful, in that they see themselves and see their children as sacred. And when they are not valued, when they are not respected, when they are despised, It is such an assault.
How did that come about? Who made the decision? How was it done?
I don't think that I could draw that out for you, except for when I think about it, one of the things that I think about is that Indian health care is in the hands of the federal government. And a lot of those people who are responsible for Indian health care have other things to gain from keeping Indian women from having children.
Did I understand you right that your quote of the statistic that 2/3 of children today are still placed in foster non-Indian homes?
Yes.
Not just sent to abortion. And is that to your experience, that seems an accurate statistic? So that would be off of the reservations, would that be? Or, you know, these statistics, does that talk about, does that include Indians wherever they are?
I think so. I think that is a global figure.
All so that would still be together. Some kind of a government policy then?
So we'll go ahead to the next one.
Let's pick up on realized eschatology. There was a few folks here. Oh, yeah, Janice and you and Beth.
Beth, is she here?
Yeah, she's up there, looking over us, looking us over. You folks want to stir us up a little bit about that one?
Well?
Go ahead.
No.
I'm going to jump in after you. I'll let you.
More on page 105. As I remember, we spent a lot of time on realized eschatology being now as opposed to that which is to come. Trying to decide or discover what that means for us and for the world. So anybody that doesn't know what eschatology is, it's the this as it's used in theology, it means that which is to come, the end time or the second coming of Christ. What we were talked about is that it's already here. That's what it seems to be saying. Or at least that's what Fox seems to be saying. And we struggled with what that means for those of us who are fairly well fed, and or I struggled with that. Those of us who are fairly well fed and fairly well taken care of, it's easier to experience the now than it might be if I were a severely oppressed person, whether it's in poverty or in some system of total injustice. And that sometimes it is easier to look forward to that, you know, right now is such an awful time, but there will be a better time, the promise of that which is to come. It's kind of that which keeps people going. If we're talking about it being right here, where's the promise? Where is it? But that was my struggle.
Beth, do you have anything to toss in? Okay. Some responses from the rest before Janice responds? Don't raise any questions?
Oh, I was impressed by 104 on top. By the Mahatma Gandhi quote, but also where it says time. It says, more and more I feel that people of ill will have used time much more effectively than people of goodwill. You know, we must use time more creatively and so on and so forth. But if I was struggling with the fact that people of goodwill don't seem to know or have the push to get on with it or have to being accountable. I feel that way, that I haven't been accountable enough in the past. That's what I'm struggling with. You know, that whole paragraph, now is the time. Mm-hmm. Now is the time to lift our national policy from the quicksands of racial injustice and so on.
Really slams the fundamentalists, you know, the ones that promote the, that they're praying for the, you know, apocalyptic times.
Mm-hmm.
Christian rights. And they're the same constituents that are for build up in armaments to bring about this.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And then he talks about just everyday people, how we escape the present by drugs, by alcohol, by going shopping, which amounts to the same thing. That was a quote by Ernest Becker.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was interesting. Shopping.
I did too, because I've done that, you know, an hour and a half on the mall just like the meal, you know.
And the preoccupation he talks about on 105 of the past, of all being focused into Lent or whatever it is, if that is strictly just looking at the past, or even in anticipation of the future. That back to creation, Bethlehem, Golgotha, this is top of page 105. That can easily be distorted into that kind of preoccupation rather than if Jesus died or Mary had a baby. Where does he say that? 106, Eckhart. What good is to me if Mary gave birth to the Son of God 1,400 years ago and I don't give birth to God's Son in my person, in my culture, in my times? Where is Jesus born today? Where did Jesus die today? Where did Jesus rise today? This kind of nowness perception too of our spiritual journey.
Elmer, were you here when Rand gave her talk a couple of times about ongoing creation? What did she call it?
In the process theology.
Oh, process theology, yes. Mm-hmm.
I see more and more connections.
Mm-hmm.
We're in a constant state of creation.
Mm-hmm. That would be the creation center thrust rather than preoccupation, either the past or that future whatever, that it is possible to live in the now because the rule is now. God's activity, God's creative energy is now. How does that fit?
Well, if now is the only important moment, if now is what's happening, not only in terms of just the fact that I'm alive and I'm here in this space, but because I am a part of a foundation for the future, a piece of the puzzle of what's to come. The importance of my life, the importance of who I am, the importance of everything that I do weighs on me, and I feel the responsibility of who I am. And I think that the traditions of storytelling and ritual and the teaching that every moment is sacred in so many of the different cultures. And let me just throw that in there in case some of you are unaware that when we talk about Indians. You know, we really have to understand that that's a very, very, very poor word. And we try not to use it as much as possible. That more and more people are... Well, let's just do something real quickly. How many of you are Indian? In some part. And what kind of Indian? You don't know. That's lost. That's not unusual. Anybody else?
Not that I'm aware of. That's all I can say.
I am a Lakota, which is a Siouan people. And we were the people who originally lived in Ohio, the beautiful Ohio and Kansas Valley and area. And pressures from the people of the East pushed us from that very fertile and beautiful land. There were a moving people, a wandering people, and they may have at one time traveled clear to Appalachia and even to the coast on different moments and interacted with the Iroquois Confederacy. We may at times, in when the weather was such from the north that we would have moved down and interacted with the Seminole and the people in Florida and clear to the south, you know, people in Louisiana. We were a moving people. We could have gone as far south on years and as far west as the Rockies and as far north as Hudson Bay. In other words, we were on the move and we followed according to our needs and our motions. So that you can't say we were a people of one little piece of the land, but we were pushed continuously westward as it became more and more difficult to move in the East. When we talk about Indians, like in my experience, I have lived in Colorado where there were the Apache and the Paiute and people that moved through that area. I have been in the Southwest with the Navajo and the Hopi, in California with the Hoopa and the... there's so many. Can't pull those out of my head right at the moment. But as you come up there in the Northwest, there the Klamath and the Warm Springs, the Wasco, the Paiute, the Nez Perce, the Umatilla, the Dalles people, the Chehalis, out in Hoquiam, the Quinault, the Macaw. You know, understand, it's very important that you understand that there is no one Indian person. No Indian is... Indian means the peoples that were here, the bands and tribes and nations that covered this land before the non-Indian came. And it's really important to have that sense when we talk about Indian. That's really important. The time concept, this is now. It's important for you also to know, I think, that you need to let go of an image of Indians, that Indians are gone. If you think about what you've heard and what you've been taught and what you've seen, I picked up some books in the library. And especially in your childhood, you were probably taught that there aren't any Indians. That Indians are a dying race. That Indians do not exist. And that is a mistruth, that now there are Indians everywhere in this nation. And you need to maybe think on, what would you gain if you could believe that there were no Indians? What would that mean to this country? Why would this idea be out there that there are no Indians, that Indians are dying out? That would be a thing to know. There are Indians. We are alive in the sense of the via positiva. There is much life and vitality in Indian world. And that is a moment of now, I think, that you need to get in touch with. And I think I'll let go.
Do they have a view of a coming eschatology? I mean, the future after death? What kind of a view is there about that in the Indian spirituality? Our bromide is the old stuff about, you know, in the sky or whatever. But I don't know.
That's a real hard question to answer. And one way to do that is to maybe talk about this place. When I sit here and I think about this place, I think about, like, as I came up Lake Chelan, I thought about the native people that traveled up and down. And for me, they are there. So that in one sense, what's in the future is what is now. That after death, there is a sense, a teaching, for example, that by my being here, and it's interesting if you are a physicist to look at that from the perspective of physics, that by being here, you know, my molecules are here. And as I sit in this room, as you sit in this room, your body is giving out pieces of yourself, and they are becoming a part of this place, and they will remain a part of this place, and they will be taken in to, like, as we're with each other, we are exchanging. What's it? Something like every I'm not a physicist, but I do know that we do exchange. I am taking in your molecules. You are becoming a part of me. The air that you're breathing out, I'm breathing in. We are, and this is in an Indian teaching, so that for me, I would see myself 20 years ago also in this room, and myself 20 years from now also in this room. I feel those miners who first worked here also in this room. So there's a sense of, if, you know, if this belief that there are no more Indians ever came true, we wouldn't believe that we were gone. And you know, you've heard some great speeches, and many of the elders will say this, that even when the last, quote, Indian blood is gone, the people of this country will never be free of Indians, because we are always here. That when I come to you and be with you, my mother is here too. She stays with me. Another thing I want to share with you on that too is,
Well, a couple things. Last night I said, I am the seventh generation. You know, I actually am the great-great-granddaughter of Red Cloud. Red Cloud was one of those persons in my heritage. So in a sense, I am Red Cloud here with you. And so that's another element of what we believe, I think. A lot of people believe, a lot of Indian people believe this, that the land that our parents die in, and our grandparents and our great-grandparents, the earth itself is part of the ongoing life after death. The bones of our people are sacred to us. And if you know anything about the history of grave robbing and digging up the bones and that sort of thing, you can understand the incredible assault that is and continues to be.
Indeed.
Just one more thing about that. I was going to say. Oh. A couple of people in writing to me last night wanted to know what happened. How did I ever move from not wanting to die to being able to be alive? And so I thought I'd share with you another teaching that goes back to that little child. That there are a lot of teaching about that little child, that if one reason why you're gentle with your children and with yourself and with others is that your soul, your spirit does not have to stay with you. That if you beat a child, if you hurt a child, if you damage a child, that child spirit may leave it, its body, and stay near, but there is a sense that you really can't hurt that child, because the essence of that child will leave that physical body at that point of being damaged, you know, so that if you're really being abused or beat, your spirit will leave. And I believe that some of the elders would say to me that the first betrayal of my innocence and trust and the first abuse was the beginning of my spirit leaving me. And that as I am healed, it is because I am now safe, I am no longer abused, and my spirit, that part of God, that energy of God, has always been near my body, but is now being able to return and be a part of me again. And that is a possible traditional explanation of how I am becoming well. And so that's kind of an interesting thought,
I should say,
to apply.
Any responses to any of you? Any questions about both the nowness and the ongoing spirit? I just had a good feeling when she said she was coming up the lake with all the other Indians who have gone up there. I just really, I was into that.
About the time, I heard, if I had, Native Americans, a clinic said they don't set up appointments with their clients. It's on a walking basis because of their concept of time compared to our Western group.
Can we laugh about things like Indian time? Because lots of people want to know, when are you going to do this or that or the other thing? And your question about living in two worlds, sometimes time is the hardest thing of all, because there is a sense of the sacredness of this moment and the responsibility of this moment, that what I'm doing now is what I must do. And I have to stay with it until it's finished, whatever that is. So that, and it's sort of an issue of the fullness of time, so that when the time is right that I am in need, nothing else comes first. If I need healing, then everything else stops, and I go to get the healing that I need. And if I don't need it now, if it's not time for that, then I don't go. It's a sense of always sort of listening to the spirit of what should I do? You know, what's next? And it makes it real hard, because like if you came to me and you needed to talk, then I would stay with you as long as you needed me to stay, and nothing else would come between that, not eating or sleeping or drinking water or going out or anything. Nothing would come until the time for me to be with you was finished. Okay.
And I'll take that a little farther. If you were doing something for yourself, and someone came in on that, what would happen? Whose time, your time, is more sacred than anybody else's until you get through, right?
Well, probably not, because of the importance of that person that came in the door. If it was another thing, you know, if it was my hunger or something that came, you know, the time to eat came, but what I was doing was very important, then the hunger would wait. But you are so special and sacred that it would be important for me to pay attention to you, no matter what it was that I was doing.
How do you feel about being that mixed in your background, or don't you?
Well, sometimes it's really hard. Sometimes, especially in terms of worship, because there's, and talking to people, sometimes the things that we're saying are so important, and it's really wrong to stop because of the time. You know, it's, you know, if we are doing something that's really significant in terms of reconciliation or learning or healing, and you have this preconceived time structure that says stop this and go do this, it's very frustrating. And almost seems wrong, and you know, it doesn't feel right to stop some of the things that we're doing just because it becomes a certain time.
Well, I wanted to say about that. One time when I was here, Jerry Diamond, his wife, here for classes he taught, I think. And usually, when you come to all the people that you talk to, want to know where you come from, where you were born, and you get into long conversations that you don't even think about until you're in the middle of them. And I don't know how this came about, but it came about that I said, I'm all German. My sister said, we're all German. He said, hold on now a minute. Now I said, I know as far as my great-grandparents, we're all German. He said, that's just the point. Maybe four or five or six generations back, you were something else. So now I don't say I am 100% German, because I'm not sure I'm 100% German. I'm 100% German as far as I know. I've always said, as far as he knows.
Anyway, I think maybe we could go ahead and...
Sure.
I was just going to share something about Honeywell and working with Native American people who worked at Honeywell, who were Native American people, having to do... Honeywell did sort of a study to help them understand that concept of time, because when somebody would die on the reservation, they would just go. That was the priority. That was the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they wouldn't call in and say they were going. The employee would not call and say, I'm going home for a funeral. That person would just go and then come back when was time, and it would roll off the schedule, you know, of the company. And I don't know exactly how that all worked itself out, but I think, you know, I think that they managed in some ways to effect a compromise there in the industry itself, in terms of trying to understand how that worked. But that was that time concept.
Major problem.
Very difficult.
In Indian people working. It's a major problem because you have spiritual ceremonies, which are considered absolutely essential to ongoing life. Mm-hmm. And work does not take precedence over spiritual ceremonies. So that when you have a funeral, or you have a sun dance, or you have some things, and they, you know, in Indian country, they don't take one day or one afternoon for a funeral. It might be 5 days, or, you know, it really depends on so many things and your relationship to this relative. And so that's really a problem. And then in order to be Indian in today's world, you need time to return to Indian style. So people's careers are very often just totally disrupted because you go along and you're working in a career, but now it's time for Sundance. And so you have to quit your job and go to Sundance. That might take 2 months. You come back, you know, you don't have a job, so it's real hard.
Yeah.
Put those two cultures together.
Just to wrap the via positiva for a moment, how are you a friend of creation? The call for path one is befriending the creation. How do you see yourself as friend? And maybe a second, if you want to answer that, where do you need to or want to grow in your friendship?
Well, that I'm so much a part of it that I can't help but respond to things that I see and feel around. Mm-hmm. Not just the magnificent things like when I go hiking and I'm up at the top of a mountain, mm-hmm. but also little things.
Tony Olson.
But
the theme on humility, I think the one I liked best, or spoke to me a lot, particularly in my early studies about in some tapes I listened to on Genesis and creation and man and word derivatives coming from human and humus and out of the earth and part of the earth and harmony is just ties in with mm-hmm. what I think about life. Yeah.
Thank you. Wells, how do you see yourself as friend?
What impressed me about her last presentation is it is something that the Native American culture can teach us because we wouldn't have as many emotional and mental problems, so on, if there was a more of a sense of this time that you need for yourself and for a spiritual growth. We pack too much in our week, our month, and our year, and then we go umpteen months on vacation, and we don't have that built in right now to our busy workaday world.
Well, so how do you see yourself as a friend of creation?
I'm trying to work toward being feminine. In holiness, the sacredness, the smallest things, and the moments. And I was just thinking about celebration of discipline, the prayer or something. And one of the things he said was flash prayers. You see a person, you said a prayer by your look or whatever, and they don't realize maybe that you said a prayer or read. Mm-hmm. I guess seeing the holiness of it all.
Mm-hmm. Someone else? Thank you.
I think mine has really been with not only trying to develop an empathy, but with trying to overcome the political ideologies that I grew up with, and to get past that American superiority complex and realize the interconnectedness of all peoples and the state of our ecology and ecosystem that we're living, and trying to, you know, develop a conception of how we can keep growing and continue living together.
Thank you. It's maybe one answer sure. to one of the questions you gave yesterday was, what is it that we're not getting as mm-hmm. non-Indians?
Yes.
What is it that we aren't hearing? And I've thought about that quite a bit, that if there was one thing that I would like us as Americans to let go of, is any kind of an idea that others, and I guess I might express it this way, you know, it's really interesting to understand why it's been put out this way, but it is truly not true that there's any such thing as first world or third world. You know, we do not have three worlds. We have only one world. And if there's one thing that we have to let go of and learn, is that we are all related. That the message that is reflected in foreign policy and in so many things is that we are, you know, the thing that we haven't learned, we haven't got right, we have to go back to the beginning, is that we are one world. If you can take those who suffer and who are oppressed and imagine or intellectualize them living in another world other than your world, then they are not your responsibility. They are not your brothers and sisters. They are unfortunately struggling with their own existence and has nothing to do with you and yours. That is a lie. That is not true. And that's the one that I would say.
That's good.
We haven't got...
almost some of the exact words from Zephaniah Kamita, who was here from Africa, saying the same thing to us, saying, you know, stop saying this third world, but this one. Yes?
Just along with what she said, and then I was sharing the devotion this morning, I just had this little illustration, maybe you've heard it, where the people were all out in the world, and a whole bunch of people, and one end of the leak, and they were bailing like mad that it was a losing battle. And the one person seeing on the other end was sitting there saying, boy, I'm sure glad the leak's in there. And
of course.
There's another idea that if you go back to the very beginnings of the earth, there were much fewer people, and that in relation to now, I'm probably related to just about everybody in some respect. And most people are related as, you know, 50th cousins or something like that. But that from the very origins, we are related. Our ancestors are related. So in that respect also, we are mm-hmm. all related to everyone in the world.
Can I bring up a, this sounds a little simple. But take an example. If you're related to the Khomeini, okay. If you're related to him, and you accept that fact, or anyone that you don't understand, or something that you would probably not get along with. Okay.
if you're related to them, are they a close relation or a distant relation? I think that's important to keep in mind, because I can think of lots of relatives I have that I know absolutely nothing yeah. about, except that they are relatives. Yeah.
I think that we're struggling with that concept of one world and all our brothers when we talk about the nuclear race, because we know that at the very worst, the whole world will be gone, and we don't strive just to keep our little place free, but the whole world free of nuclear holocaust.
It's all a really good introduction to the via negativa, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That, you know, the silence, the pain, and the nothingness.
And that's what we will talk about tomorrow, then, via negativa, and Friday, excuse me, and have Janice to respond to us again there. Whew, not tomorrow. I'm aching for that solitude day.
Let me just come back to the concepts sure. that we use, third world, first world, and so on. That if the concept of one world, understand and get away from the third world kind of description, first world, because it separates, makes a division, and it doesn't bring the unity concept. But just to go a step further in terms of what I think the concepts, it does that. But it also is there to try to describe something else. I think, you know, the difference in economics between a first world country and a third world country, or the difference in the industrialized concept and so on. I think when you recognize differences between different parts of the world or country and on other bases, whatever those bases might be, then somehow the description has developed third world, first world. So if we try to get away from what the word to a lot of people does is right away bring up separation, how should we describe differences in talking about the total world of that world, people, the haves and have-nots? You know, there isn't equality. And so if you're trying to work with that, how should we replace concepts of third world, first world differences and not use those descriptions? Any more questions?
I guess my question is not looking at, well, what are the differences and how do we describe that? Mine is on a whole other end. How do you describe the sameness that we all have? And answer that responsibility that, you know, granted they're in a lower economic level, but I don't know, that just points to me as, you know, I'm responsible for some of that. But, I mean, not all of it, but...
Just as Janice last night identified herself as part of this whole cosmos and then talked about her own needs, so it was a descriptive thing of her being and world. And yet, and that's what I hear you asking for, what's possible to say, she is distinct from some of the rest of them. Then she wanted to know where we were and heard back from us. I think it's possible for that kind of communication, not assuming that everyone is the same because we're in that world. But it's, I think, the categories, like first, second, third, that we tend to try to create, doesn't have to obliterate the reality of someone's experience. Often, as you were implying, we were implying, well, those are the world, those other worlds are the ones in need, and we are the ones who are going to help, which is just drastic.
I mean, first, second, and third also provides a concept is that the third, I mean, there's a, you want to be number one, in a way. Yeah. And so that they're in a position of wanting to get to number one, it seems. And so that's an unending race.
It's like, right, our family, over wherever it is, yeah, it's all of us.
The person, yeah.
The Mama concept instead of the Egyptian way.
Mm-hmm.
The person to read on that, mm-hmm. especially, is Dorothy Sollier.
Mm-hmm.
I was there when Dorothy Sollier made that presentation. And then she came to the Bellingham Forum and made a presentation. It was so incredible, because she was saying to the third world, don't try to be in the first world. It's a terrible mistake. And this woman from Korea stood up, and it really connects with what you were saying yesterday. And she said, how I would love to have the luxury of choosing
mm-hmm.
not to try to be
mm-hmm.
like America. We just don't have that luxury. We had been talking, you know, some of the issues that were lifted up at World Council, like tourism, like sustaining a luxury economy at the expense of
mm-hmm.
the natural resources of the other parts of the world. I would much rather, she said, you know, never have to deal with the issue of tourism or planting a crop to support the luxury of the first world. But I don't have any choice to survive. So that tension between Dorothy Sollier and, mm-hmm. and the third world,
mm-hmm.
the so-called, the people who are being affected by the decisions that
mm-hmm.
those who are at the top of the economic system, to hear some of that, to hear Zavanya,
yeah.
you know, it's just so exciting.
Well, thank you. We'll be back at 45 for Mr. Erlander.